morning, we are going to dismiss the children that are going to Children's Church for the first portion of the service. Go ahead and head out if they want. So just so you understand how things are going to be different this morning, and I realize that there are those who perhaps think that church starts at 10:45, and they'll have to catch up with us. The sermon's going to be done in two parts. We're looking at 1 Corinthians 11 this morning. Paul's tackling two issues that pertain to corporate worship. So we're going to be looking at both. And so the way the service, just to kind of give you this, how it's going to work this morning, I'm going to give you part one right now. Then we're going to come back and we're going to spend some time in worship and song. Then we're going to conclude that with the part two. And then that will conclude with more worship in communion itself. So, to understand here that Paul is moving on from the participation when it comes to food offered to idols, and specifically he's talking about what happens in their temples and in their homes, he's now moving into the participation of how we approach worship in our church and in our homes. Before we go into that, I do have this question for you. When you're about to do something, do you generally prepare before you're about to do whatever it is you're about to do? Think about it. You're going to go on a road trip. One usually prepares, right? You're going to grab some snacks. You're going to grab the things that you're going to need for the destination that you're going to get to. Maybe on a shorter scale, if you're going to a concert, one usually prepares themselves to go to a concert, whether that be a grand symphony or a rock concert. You would dress appropriately for that event. You're going on vacation. You would make sure that you're taking the things that you need. You're going to the Oregon coast in the middle of the summer. You know to take a parka because you're in Oregon. And there's just things that you prepare yourself. You're about to go to your sporting event, whatever your sport might be. Don't you prepare yourself for the sport. If you're thinking baseball and you are playing football, you're going to have some confusing moments. You prepare yourself. So, how do you prepare yourself when it comes to coming to church? Or do you prepare yourself in coming to church? Now, for some, maybe that's just a matter of, hey, I made it. And the preparing is, I got up. I did whatever it was I do before I get dressed. Hopefully you do that in the right order. You don't take a shower after you get dressed, right? Maybe if you are a mom, that means you're going to have to dress your kids, including your biggest one. And you know who that is, right? That maybe there's that. Maybe you have the chance, if everything works out right, you eat breakfast before you come. And then maybe you're eating breakfast as you come, depending on your timing. And then, of course, there's that last minute scramble to find out where did I put my Bible. And there's all of these things that maybe that's how we prepare. What about this, dude? Have you ever thought about preparing for church the night before? Okay? And maybe you do. Maybe that includes getting a good night's sleep. Maybe that includes spending some time in prayer the day before, the week before even. And could I ask, what could you or what do you pray for? Do you pray that, you know, if I hope somebody comes through the door that's never come through before. I hope that somebody who doesn't know Jesus suddenly realizes that Jesus loves them. Maybe you pray for the Sunday school teachers, not just your teacher, but all the teachers, that they put some preparation into the week. And the idea is that they've got a lesson then, and that you pray that that's communicated clearly in a way that people will respond. I don't know, could I ask? Maybe you pray for me that my message is not my message, but it's his. How about this? Do you read the scripture before you come? Now, we are going exegetically, that is, verse by verse, through right now, 1 Corinthians. So it's really not a huge mystery as to where we will be from week to week. If you were here the week previous, you know at least we're going into the next chunk of verses that are coming. Last week, I actually gave the instruction. Read chapter 11 before you come. Now, some of you may have, some of you may have forgot, but do we read the scripture before we come so we can say, okay, I've read it now, let's see what Mike has to say about it. What has God led him to say about it? To understand first that coming to church doesn't start when you come through the door, but that our attitude and that our posture should be ready before we get here. I think all too often we can find ourselves guilty of church via osmosis, if you will. We just kind of get there and hope we absorb something. And anybody who knows that, you're just not going to get the same amount if you prepare. And that's true in anything in life. So certainly it should be true about church. So Paul is going to be talking in this passage about doing church and about being church. And why it is that we do what we do, that there's a reason behind it. He does this first by commending them. He commends them for remembering the things that he told them to do. This is good. But then he turns around and shows them something he doesn't commend them for, because even though they do what they do well, they have forgotten why they're supposed to be doing it. And so, to understand this, that Paul begins this whole entire passage, he goes, transitions from this place of others, okay, our response to others and our response to neighbors, to now, what is it that you, what is it that I, what is it that we are supposed to be doing? So he opens up with this commendation. You're handling things in church well. And then he quickly follows it up with the rebuke, because that's what Paul does. It's kind of a, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news, and I don't care which order you want it in, here's how it comes, right? So the commendation comes in how they maintained, and what Paul will say is traditions. We can also say the way they maintain the understandings or the teachings that Paul has established. And this is key here. That he has established, that he has planted why we do what we do. And so we begin with just simply verse 2, now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. So commend, I praise you for doing this and doing this well, is what Paul is saying. Now we need to remember, Paul planted this church. Before Paul, the church wasn't there. Okay, there might have been some scattered believers, but the church itself was established by Paul. So the traditions are Paul. Anytime somebody utters the words in Corinth, that's the way we've always done it. It's what they're saying is that's the way Paul did, because there hasn't been a before Paul moment. Okay, so he's saying you have held on to things that I told you. This is how church is done. You've done that. That's good. However, Paul then slides in the infamous, but, okay, and that is to say, yes, you're doing this, however, something's amiss. And he wants to make sure that that doesn't happen. He says, yeah, you are doing what you're supposed to be doing, but I'm not sure you remember why it is that you're doing. I want us, and this is Paul speaking, I want us to be on the same page, okay, the why you're doing it. And you're not doing it because Paul said it. You're not doing it because, as you remember at the beginning of 1 Corinthians, so very long ago that we were there, you're not doing it because of Apollos, you're not doing it because of Cephas. Okay? That's not the why. In fact, just earlier, Paul uses this word, I don't want you to be unaware. That's to suggest that there's a room for night in it, right? That they just don't know. Here, this is, I don't want you to forget what you do know. Okay, so he continues, he says, I want you to understand, I want you to recall or remember that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. I'm going to stop right here, and I'm going to preemptively tackle some things so that we can get through this passage. If you know this passage, you know the text that's about to come. And it starts to look like this passage is about a woman's place in the church. And this is how this passage usually gets taught. And I'm going to say it right now, stop it. That's not the point of this verse. It's not Paul's point. The passage has been used by people so poorly. And they make it about, they make it about the right to oppress women. And I'm talking about both on the conservative side and on the liberal side. I've got liberal friends who say, I can't even tolerate your Christianity, Mike. I can't tolerate the Bible because it's so oppressive towards women. And I'm like, where do you see this oppression that you're talking about? All you have to do, and they'll point it out, all you have to do is read 1 Corinthians 11, or maybe they'll say 1 Corinthians 11, I don't know. But they say, all you have to do is read that. And I'm like, you're reading it wrong.
there are those who will do that, but at the same time, there are other people on the other side who specifically say,
a woman needs to know her place. Paul does. That's not what this verse says.
It's not what any of these verses say. This is not about a superiority, unless the superiority is Christ as the head.
The key to understanding and then therefore applying this passage is found actually just right there in verse 3. The question we should ask on any passage, who is this being addressed to? And it's not just being addressed to the Corinthians. It's being addressed to a very specific group. Who? Husbands and wives. Much of the context that Paul is about to share is in the context of marriage. And he's going to use marriage as the thing that sets an example. This is first to be applied to the marriage. What does that mean? That means anybody who's not married can take a nap now. No. It means that if you are hopeful to be married, then you should step back and remember, this is the way it is. And there is an equation that's being held here. Christ, husband, wife. So what happens when in this particular equation, what happens when the husband is removed from that equation? Whether he's dead or he's not a believer, what does that mean? That wife, the woman, still has what? She still has a head over her. What is that? That's Christ. So at the end of the day, it's Christ is above all. This is not a chunk of verses about men and women as individuals. We're in the context of marriage. It has to be written. So, let's read the remainder of this portion of the passage. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? And just real quick, can we adjust that screen? It looks like an awful little bit there. But I want you to see where Paul is going with this. Paul seems to be talking in some circles. Men, cover your head. So we understand he's not talking about take off the baseball caps. He's not talking about take off hats. That's not what this is talking about. Okay? He's talking about this covering of the head. In fact, when it says the cover of the head, we think the top. And that's not what he's talking about. He's really talking about the whole thing, but in particular, he's talking about the face. He's saying to men, when you pray boldly. You pray open. Right? There's nothing blocking you. That's the way it's supposed to be. Now, there's a lot of contradictory stuff that can happen here, and people will say this, because wait a minute, doesn't Jesus say to go pray privately? Doesn't he say to pray in your prayer closet? And by the way, a prayer closet is not a legitimate room in your house as much as it is a shawl that you would put over your head. Doesn't that contradict what Paul's saying? No. He's just saying that in this example here, there is somebody who has a head covering and there's somebody who doesn't have a head covering. You who don't have the head covering, you pray boldly. You happen to be husbands, your men. Okay? It's not talking about take off your hats. Okay? Now, the women, he turns around and says, now you do cover your head. Now, he says, you have long hair. Long hair serves as a veil all by itself. It's a natural veil is what it is. The idea with the long hair is that it does cover your face if you're in a prostrate position and you are down forward, right? That's what would happen. And so there's this picture of that. But then you have to stop and say, wait a minute. Why a veil? Why are we even talking? What is this whole veil thing? We're going to deal with it. We're going to talk about that. And then he even throws in there, oh, by the way, don't shake your head. Don't cut your hair short. Every single woman's doing this, right? Understand, culturally, Old Testament, if a woman was unfaithful, she would have her hair chopped off. Why? Because it's a visible thing. In fact, that's kind of the picture that you have to place yourself in a moment here. The longer the hair of the woman, the longer she's been married is the idea.
The Amish do it with the beards. In fact, there's a lot of cultures that do it. No, I'm not Amish, obviously. The beard, the idea of the beard of a man is, it's a visible sign. That man, he's happily married. The long hair was is a visible sign of a woman being happily married. Okay? So if the hair was short, it communicated something else. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about visible things. He's also talking about invisible things. If all of a sudden out of nowhere, Paul slides in angels.
What?
It's to say this, women, even if you're in a group of just women, don't forget, angels join us in worship too. There's a reason for this veil, and we'll talk about what that reason is. This passage is not about the veil. It's not about the men versus the women. This passage is about order. There's an order that Paul is addressing here. Paul uses the context of married people as a way to demonstrate this order. There's an order of responsibility. What is the responsibility of a husband? Okay, and now we look at the equation for a moment. The husband has a responsibility to who? He has a responsibility to Christ, and he has a responsibility to his wife. What is the wife's responsibility? Well, she has a responsibility to her husband. And then you'll notice how Paul puts that out. What does he end the sentence with? Oh yeah, don't forget God and Christ again. So she has a responsibility also to who? To Christ. So don't lose placement here. Paul also uses the creation account itself to establish what this set order looks like and why. That how God created mankind in order is important. Order matters. It tells us something about who we are. This is not about woman being last on the list. It's not about woman being last. In fact, guys, for a moment here, if anything, this passage is about us doing our job. That's what this passage is about. We are to shepherd what has been given to us. We have been given, hold on to that word, we have been given these wives. We have been given this family because all things come from who? God. You better be doing your job. That's what Paul is reminding us to do here. Men, if you want to make this about order, and there are men who do, you want to make this about order, who's first, who's last? And if we think that's important, and we think it's important to put woman at the end of the line, stop and think about creation for a moment. I just want to stop and think about it for a second. What was created before man? Everything. Everything else was created before man, right? So in that thought, just for a second here, men, if we want to talk about who's first, I would remind us that rocks were created before us, and they never need reminding how to praise God. Just saying. This passage is using cultural references, some of which simply do not apply to us today, but the reason, the spirit of why it's being said does. The way we approach it is this. The principle is the same, but the practice may not be. Culturally, it's understood that if a woman was wearing a veil, she was married. I'm talking about in everyday life. She has a veil on her head, it is because she is married. Today, we do that differently. Here, how do we do it today, usually? Got a ring, right? And so, now some cultures, other cultures would do that as well. But the idea here, in this particular culture, if she had a veil on, just like today, they have a ring on, what does that mean? Take it. This person belongs to another. Better said, this person does not belong to you. You weren't supposed to look on a woman anyways in that culture, because quite frankly, men, if you did, you were being disrespectful to her. And at the same time, women were cautioned not to do something that would cause a man to look on you, because then you bring disrespect on him. The veil simply said, this one's off limits. We just stop and consider for a moment David and Bathsheba. David's walking across the rooftop. He looks down at Bathsheba. What was the sin? Was the sin that he looked at Bathsheba? No. The sin was that he kept looking. The sin was that he kept coming back for more. The sin was that he went and called her in. If she was simply wearing a veil on that rooftop, it wouldn't have been a problem. No, David should have known that's not mine. So at this point, I'm just going to stop and say, if you're thinking, wait a minute, hold on, this whole thing,
like, that's
okay. That's barbaric. I'm just going to tell you real simple. It doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what you think, because it doesn't dismiss that this is the historical context of these verses. And if we're going to understand what Paul is saying, we have to understand what he was saying for the time that he was saying. It's the way things were. And so to help us understand how to apply the truth, because the truth is still relevant, the truth is still there, we need to understand how it was and what it needs to be now. The point here is not that you wear a veil, that in that time, they did wear a veil. And this is what the veil served as purpose. This is the why and what it meant, so that we can see what that looks like today. Now, as Paul brings up the veil, he's ultimately giving this nod to the reader that he is concerned with a group of very specific people in the church of Corinth. Who? We've already addressed this. The married people. He has some concern there. He doesn't want to see them get out of order. He doesn't want them to forget why the order matters. Now, this could mean, if we use the context of other verses in 1 Corinthians, it could mean that maybe some of the women were doing the job that the men were called to do because the men weren't doing it. That is true. But he deals with that later. That's not right now. It also can mean that maybe perhaps some of the men were lording their position over the women. That is true, and he has already dealt with that, and he will deal with it again. This is not, by the way, about limiting what a woman can and cannot do. It represents the simple fact, if there's ever a void, and quite frankly we know nature abhors a void, if there's ever a void, usually somebody will come in to fill it. So if there is a job that men were called to do and men are not doing it, it will probably find itself filled with people who were not called to do it. And we need to understand, quite frankly, that sometimes that void needs to stay that way. Because otherwise what we get is the impression that everything must be okay because things are getting done. But they're not getting done the way that God has called them to be done. I'm not saying this limits what women can and can't do. It's saying that perhaps men are not doing enough. By the way, men, next week, Mother's Day. Don't forget that. I will say that the church, and when I talk about the church, I'm talking about the church, has found itself today, 2,000 years removed from Christ, finding it harder and harder to find men who desire to serve. And if it continues down this path, as it has in Australia, as it has in the UK, as it has in Russia, here in America as well, the church, as we know it, will die like an unhealthy body. By the way, Paul deals with that too. Paul is suggesting that the order of creation is important. We ultimately really don't have a problem, I think, of grasping that God should be before us, right? That's pretty simple. We understand that. Now, that might be the struggle for some coming to the gospel because the idea of, wait a minute, something's more important than me? Yeah, you are not the center of the universe? Right. So we understand that God is above us. We don't really have a problem with that. But then the question of the rest of the order becomes important. In fact, if we stop and we think about creation, all of creation's order makes sense, doesn't it? Can you imagine creating the beasts of the earth, day 6, before you decided to make land, day 3? What would you have? You'd have a lot of floating cows out there is what you would have. Obviously, God put land there first, knowing he was going to fill said land with the beasts, right? How about the plants that are on that land? They come there day 3. Would it be smart to make the plants before you make the sun? How do plants grow? They need the sun. So what happens? Day 1, you get the sun. Day 3, we get the plants that benefit. So what do we have here? It's really simple. Day 6 is dependent on day 3, which is dependent on day 1. which, by the way, all of which are dependent on what?
God.
Order matters. Paul's suggesting the same thing here, but using humans as a microcosm. Yes, man. And when I say man, male. You were made first when it comes to humans. And then somewhere in that process of creation, it was decided that man by himself, man alone, was not good. You understand, up to that point in time, all of creation, everything's good. Let it be, and it was good. Let there be, and it was good. Let there be, and it was good. Everything. And then suddenly man, being alone, God says, not good. Something's not good here. Did God make a mistake? I mean, when he made cows, he made male and female of their kind. When he made birds, he made the male and the female. Which came first, chicken or the egg, it doesn't matter, they both were there. Okay, but he made everything in its kind, male and female, at the same time, except for man. Did God make a mistake in not doing what he did with the rest of the animals and the rest of creation as a whole? No. Why? Because man is different. And it's set apart as different. It was created different. We were not spoken into existence. We were handcrafted into existence. Man has a different place in it all. And man needs to inherently understand things. Man is taught things. It says that God taught man as he walked with him in the pool. And so man learns things, doesn't just assume things. Man is different. Man needs to learn, and by being created alone, it was that man needs to depend on someone else. And who will fill that void of the someone else? Well, first, the need needs to be who? God. He needs to recognize this is the order. Who is before him? God. So he needs God. And then he needs somebody else. What? He needs someone else to remind him, someone to walk with him in this. Man was created to live, created to live, not discovered, created to live in plurality, not single. Not singular. Now, Paul earlier tackles that whole topic of marriage. He says, you know, at the end of the day, it's actually better not to be married so you can be free to the gospel. That's because that's what Paul is ultimately married to. But we all know that that's not the promise that was given to us. That's not even the command that was given to us. Paul recognizes that we are supposed to multiply. And that does not happen by yourself. Paul would say that his head is Christ, and that's enough for him, but that for us, that to be married is to be in this plurality. And while there is an equality within man and woman as far as being human, we are all the same that way. The order is what is important. Paul does this so we understand the reason we do what it is that we do because of how things have been set. It establishes that an order was important because it dictates the responsibilities. Later in other letters, Paul would say it this way. Husbands, love your wives. How? As Christ loved the church. So we see that this is our responsibilities. So with that, Paul gets into this order of things and he uses the veil as the example. See, the veil was to be worn, and by the way, Paul is talking about in this moment of prayer and prophecy, which was a good chunk of the service time. Prophecy, by the way, is the declaration of truths from God, usually done in a form of worship. Paul is not talking about future casting here. He is not talking about unknown or new revelation here. That's all been given. There is no mysteries left in Christ. Okay? We'll deal with that in the next chapter when we deal with the spiritual things and spiritual gifts. What becomes interesting here is this question, why do women need to cover and men don't need to cover? Does this show that women are somehow inferior? Let me explain. It goes back to the order. See, man was made by God. Woman was made from man. Still made by God, mind you, but they're made from man. The key word that Paul uses there is this thing that revolves around glory. The word is doxa. And doxa is used to describe all things illuminated. right? Things that are bright. And in particular, it's used in context of the sun and the moon. By the way, does the moon emit its own light? Science 101, right? No, it does what? It reflects the sun. Beautiful picture of the gospel right there. So we have this reflection, and that's what glory is. Glory is a reflection. We need to understand that all light comes from God first. And in fact, even when we get to new heaven and new earth, apparently there's no sun, but there's light. What's going on there? Because that's who God is. And so we need to understand that this picture of this reflection of glory, and at the end of the day, though, we need to remember that we are all image bearers. We bear His image. We reflect the very image of God. Paul would say we are His masterpiece. We are His poema. So women, by reason of God's order, they bear His glory, yes, but they also bear the glory of man. Paul says that. Why? Because of the order. The woman reflects both God and man. And the reflection of man is the reflection of God. So it's kind of a double reflection, if you will. The reason a woman has to cover is because she has to cover the glory of man. That's, she was made from us. That's the part that must be covered when going into the presence of God. She doesn't cover her womanhood. She doesn't cover because she's a woman. It is to remove that which is of man. Garland, he says it this way concerning this whole veil. He says, the requiring the head covering, it does double duty. On one hand, it serves to efface a man's glory in the presence of God. And on the other hand, it serves as a symbol of woman's authorization to pray and to prophesy. You understand we're all called to pray. We're all called to prophesy in this way. Man and woman. Joel says it. Old Testament. We're all called to. And the permission that you need is that you can come before God. That is the authorization. We use that word wrong sometimes. It means you have been granted access. Okay? You have been authorized. You are appropriate to come in. You cover the glory of man that you might enter in. Man is no different. Isaiah before the throne of God, he recognized that he had something in his life that could not be before God. But take care of that. That's what the veil does. So why? Why do we see this passage all too often abused, shaming women? Men, can we just stop for a second? Do you understand the reason they have to wear the veil? Because of us, right? That's what's happening. Now, Paul's goal is not to objectify, devalue, or shame. That's what happens when we make this about us. It's not about us. This passage is about right attitudes, especially when it comes to prayer and prophecy, because that's what Paul's talking about here. When you come together and pray, pray proper. Have the right attitude. Come prepared. Women, you married women, you happen to have a veil with you. Use it. That's what he's saying. Prepare yourself. This isn't a passage saying women should wear veils or burqas or whatever all day long. That's not what it's saying. Now, the married woman already would. The single woman, the widow, you don't have to. Okay? Unless you're coming in for prayer and prophecy, that's when this cultural moment would happen. So Paul uses the marriage veil as the symbol of what commitment and submission to an authority that is not our own looks like. Women, you would be wearing the veil because you're married. You wear that because you submit to the authority of your husband. Submit to God the same way. That's what he's saying. That's a reminder that we're all, men and women, we're all under submission. We're all under authority, whether we accept it or not. And if the man is doing the task that he has been given, then that task will reflect Christ. And if it reflects Christ, it will reflect onto his wife. It better. This is how Paul then connects the thoughts of chapter 10 to 11 when he says, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. It's the exact picture. Husbands, wives, the reflection. Quickly, other misuses in the verse. Can men have long hair? The answer, yes. I would remind you that Paul, while writing this, was underneath the Nazarite vow. The Nazarite vow was this, that as long as you were in the vow, there were things that you did not partake in, including getting your hair cut. Okay? When they would come to the end of their Nazarite vow, they would shave their head. Remember Samson? Samson had long hair. This is not about the length of hair. By the way, the women of the day with the long hair would rival Rapunzel. Okay? So we're talking long, we're talking long. Okay? The hair was again the reflection of the marriage. So we need to remember again, who is Paul already addressed up to this point? He's talked about that moment, and this is what he's alluding to. He's talking about that moment of worshiping in other temples with prostitutes. What kind of prostitutes, mind you? Male prostitutes. This is what he's talking about. There were men, actually young boys, who were told to keep their hair long and to keep growing their hair long because they would look like a woman. He's talking about these male prostitutes who would grow their hair for the purpose of looking like a woman. Again, we've shared this before without going into great detail here. The men who participated, many of them married, who participated in this worship in these temples with these young boys, would never have considered themselves homosexual. Why? Because the whole entire thing is this illusion that this young boy has taken on the role of the woman, including the long hair. And this would all go to play a part in having this dominance over somebody, rather than authority and submission, which is something I give. It's not a biblical mandate on hair for men or women. Also, culturally, and we say it even today, but when you want to relax, ladies, what do we say? You let your hair down. The hair was considered a very sensual thing in that time. So to have your hair down was, there even that, even for married women, that's why you would wear the veil, because to have that hair down, that's, whoa, cover up, right? I mean, that sounds ridiculous to us today. Never, that's not what we're worried about being covered up now. That back then it was. Many of the Greek goddess statues, they would be naked with their hair flowing down. Okay? And the hair is the only thing covering things. And it was the hair that got the guys going. Alright, that's weird. Okay, that's a different thing. Hey, maybe for somebody's not. I don't know. I'm no judge. Some of these were, the difference though is that you would have these women like Athena, for instance, hair down, and people would, oh, and she's beautiful, she worship. And then there would be another statue with her hair pulled back, and she would be in a warrior pose. Well, who was supposed to be the warriors? Who was supposed to be the men? It was confusing the roles, and that was part of this Greco-Roman culture. And Paul's saying, you need to be careful not to adapt yourself to those things. Don't measure yourself to those things. So how does it apply to us today? Do women need to all go out and buy veils right now? Because I know some of you are thinking, I'll show mine, I'm going to go buy a veil, and I'm sure my wife is spreading this morning. No. It is this, though. It really is more akin to, honestly, if we can stop, it's how we dress for church as a whole. It's our attitude and our approach of why we wear what we wear. And I will say this, that if you come dressed provocatively, and when I say that, I'm not saying you're wearing stylish clothes, you're wearing nice clothes, you're concerned that you look good, that's fine. But I'm saying, no, your purpose, your drive, is to garner the attention of somebody that is not yours. Whether you're single or not. That doesn't belong in the church. And that's what Paul's saying. Don't allow that kind of distraction to come into this place. Because this place should be about him, not us. You come to praise God, not man, or praise by man. So, should we all just turn to uniforms? That would be a whole lot easier, right? Or maybe your attitude is, hey, you know what? I think that's somebody else's issue. They'll have to deal with that. Okay, if they can't keep their eyes on me, that's not my problem. Go back to what Paul was saying before. How is it that you love your neighbor again? Are we really going to say that my right, my freedom, my lawfulness trumps how you treat somebody else? We need to create a place that people come to worship. And they need to feel that this place doesn't live by the standards set by the world. How you dress, how you look, it's the world. That's not interesting. Paul's response does pertain to a Roman Greek culture, but the
premise is still true today. God has an order that never changed. There's a reason why it is the way it is, and to understand that at the end of the day, we're all called to worship. And we're all called to worship in the same way. It does not say men, prayer, prophecy, women, don't. It says women, prepare yourself. Lucky for you guys, you don't have to worry about that part. 18. Right? That's okay. You all come to them. But men, your task is this. You need to be prepared. You need to be leading. You're supposed to be prepared. You're built by default to lead. Do it. That's what you were made for. This isn't to say that Paul doesn't deal with some of these issues, how they might arise with particular women in the church. Because he does. He does that in chapter 14. He's not doing it here. He does do it in chapter 14. And we will misread chapter 14. We will say in chapter 14, doesn't it say, Mike, that women should be silent in church? No. No, it doesn't. See, Paul's not talking about that. What he's doing is he's connecting thoughts. And again, we have to look at the bigger picture here. So Paul here is dealing with this issue of prayer and prophecy. The very next chapter, he's going to deal with what? Prayer, prophecy, and all the other giftings that we talk about, the spiritual things, and the misuse of those things, and what the intention of those things are. And then he comes back around and says, and by the way, there's some women who I would not permit to talk. Not because they're women, but because they should be allowed to talk. He's talking about very specific women in the Corinth church that are abusing their role, the order, the spiritual gifts. If it was men doing it, he would call them out. By the way, he already did. And he'll do it again in 2 Corinthians. Just to be clear, Paul is not a misogynist. The reason people come to that conclusion is because these verses have been misused. Whether it's because they've been misrepresented by somebody else or by their own personal reading. If you read it at surface level, I read that, whoa, Paul, oh, damn, I can't say that in church. Oh, I can't say what people are saying about these verses. I can say what Paul says about it. In fact, I think what's interesting is that we will read verses until we hear what we want to hear and we will stop. And this is exactly what people have done. They forget the middle of this verse. Does not nature itself, I mean, even if you don't even believe in God, right? Does not nature itself teach you that man wears long hair and it's a disgrace for him, woman long hair, right? And he goes on to there. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For a woman was made from man, so, now they're pausing, don't forget, now, right? Man is now born of woman. All things are from God. Don't forget the order. He then goes on and says, if anyone is inclined to be contentious, you want to argue this point? I'm not going to do it. No room for that in the church. You can't come to that conclusion, don't be here. That's what he's saying. That's not what the church is for. It's not what these verses are for. Don't, no contentious. There's no practice. There's no room for that. Make no mistake. Paul's declaring this is what it is. And there's no room for discussion on it. Campion and Rosner would say, our behaviors are not merely a matter of personal preference, but live out in a community context, and so the well-being of the community, which includes the others, must play an integral role in our decisions regarding the attitude and postures we assume with respect to those around us. That when we come into this place, that we come with the right attitude. In the context there, women, they would wear this. This is why we do what we do. By using the marriage relationship that, by the way, God ordained, which means God ordered. We as a church, we as married couples, we get to demonstrate to an upside down world what a right relationship with God looks like. And I would say, it's not even just limited to the married people, but there are those of you who are widowed here, and I will tell you that the stories I hear of you and your husbands, or you and your wives, are stories that sample this very thing. We get to demonstrate to an upside down world what a right relationship with God looks like. And if we mess this up, if we teach it poorly, if we demonstrate it poorly, we will forfeit our neighbors and make a mockery of the life changing power of the gospel. If we are to be one body, which Paul will talk about in the upcoming chapters, we must consider what one looks like. And there is no greater picture of what one looks like than the marriage picture. to become one. So we see it demonstrated in the community with our neighbors, and we must realize it in the community with our family. And it all begins with understanding and preparing ourselves for why we do what we do. I'm going to stop here. The worship team is going to come up. We're going to sing a couple of songs as one body, coming to worship Him. And as we do that, I would ask that you would prepare yourself as we go into the next chunk of verses, because what will happen here is we're going to walk through perhaps some very familiar verses for some, but the emphasis here is going to not be on what you know, but what you do with it, the participation portion of it. So Paul begins with a commendation, with some clarity. But make no mistake that the Corinthians were doing well in the area that they were doing well in. And Paul just wants to remind them, why they should keep on that way. Again, example to an upside down world, set apart what it means to be in the world, not of the world. That in our marriages and our relationships, we honor God, demonstrating His covenant with us as we covenant with one another. However, He does not commend, He does not praise, except for what's coming next. And the kids are going to be coming in from children's church. See, you can let them in. I want them to be a part of this too. He doesn't praise them for what comes next, which is a matter of the Lord's table. Now, remember, Paul dealt with very quickly. There's the Lord's table and there's the demons' tables. And you're either at one or the other. Whether you know it or not, you've got to be at one or the other, right? And it's in a sense what Paul is beginning here is I'm struggling. How can you be doing that part of church right but not this part of church right? And it's a very similar tone, quite frankly, as that we would find even in the letters to the churches in Revelation, isn't it? You have these moments with the churches, and it says, this is great, you're doing this well. And then the Lord says, but I have this against you. In other words, there's time to correct. You need to correct. It would seem that Paul is coming back to why the letter was written in the first place. There's reports of divisions, factions amongst them. The problem is that their participation together, it does not reflect Christ. It's reflecting something else. If the point of church, and by the way, what do we, Sunday, I don't know what you call Sunday. Sunday is the Lord's Day, is what it's supposed to be, right? And so when we come to church, when we celebrate the Lord's Day, it is to remember Christ. If the table of the Lord, which is set before us here, if the table of the Lord is about one body, a reminder of our one God and one Lord and what He has done for us, and that if we are to come together, and that word come together means to be one, if we are to come together as a church, then it needs to demonstrate a covenant relationship that is established by Jesus. Not established by who I am, where I was born, where I was raised, who my parents are, but that this covenant relationship is purely built on His blood and His blood alone. Not Paul, not Apollos, not Cephas. And remember, Paul begins by saying these words that I praise you for remembering what I taught you. And you're going to hear that word remember again in the passage we're about to look at. You remember what I told you, but I'm not sure you remember what Jesus told you. And so this is where Paul is going with this. So let's look at the next portion of the passage. But in the following instructions, I do not command you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. That's got to stink. For the first place, when you come together as a church, which is a body of believers called by God, I hear that there are divisions among you, and I believe it in part, for there must be factions among you in order for those who are genuine among you may be recognized.
Paul's saying that he wishes this weren't so, but apparently it is true that the church doesn't come together as one body, but rather they're coming together as small bodies. And there's these divisions. There's something that's dividing them. There are walls, if you will. We just got done saying. There are walls. There is us and there is them. And understand that it's not theology that's dividing them. And it's not even doxology, the glory of God, that's dividing them. How can they say, I am of, and somebody else says, no, but I am of? What are they really saying? I'm of self. I'm not of the covenant. I'm not of Jesus. That's what they're saying. So what is it? What is it that divides them? So on one hand, it's interesting. Paul says, you know, quite frankly, there should be divisions among you. He actually says it there. If you look at the word. He's saying it facetiously, though. Because he's saying, I know when you come together, not everybody's saved. I know that. I would be dumb to think that everybody is of the same body. There are people who aren't. So obviously that would divide people. That might divide somebody. There are those who come with a different reason. I ask you, why do you come to church? What is your reason? What is your purpose? What is your goal? What is your drive? What do you hope to get out of it? What do you hope to put into it? Why do you come to church? People come for different reasons. And not all of it's for God's glory. That would divide. That would certainly divide. So there should be a divide. The thing is, it shouldn't be inside the church. He's also using their logic ironically, because if we have to take from all, remember, this is one letter. So we take what we call chapter 12. If we were to look at chapter 12, we're not right now. We go to chapter 12. We see this picture. He's talking about spiritual things, spiritual giftings. And there are people who feel that one gift is more important than the other. And if their gift wasn't there, then the church would fall apart. And there are those who feel that they should be giving more honor to some parts of the body, but not other parts of the body. So the underlying thought that Paul is applying here, that he'll use there, there are some of you who think maybe you're better than others. He's talking to the Corinthians. I think some of you think you might be above somebody else in the church. See, they've forgotten the cross. They've forgotten what the cross does. The cross levels the playing field. The cross doesn't level the playing field so we can go and rebuild ourselves. It doesn't level the playing field so you get. Do we approach the gospel this way? I come to Jesus, why? So I can start over. No, you don't start over. You're just going to build the same mess again. You start new. And it's, we don't come together to puff ourselves up. Look how important I am. We come to build others up, even if it means that we might not. Do we have to go back to the history lesson? Do we have to go back to Babel to understand what it means when we build what we want to build? Not what God has called us to build. When you come together, it's not the Lord's Supper that you eat. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. What? I love that. What? It's not even a question mark, right? What? What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you on this? No, I will not. You're just mad. You're shaking the game right now. I will not. Communion is about community in covenant relationship. We have two relationships. We have a vertical relationship and we have a horizontal relationship. The vertical relationship is my relationship with God. And everything that happens, again, think sun and moon for a moment here, right? He's the sun, I'm the moon. And my relationship better reflect outward. And that my relationship horizontal should be a demonstration of what my relationship with him. If this relationship isn't working, these ones won't work. If I'm too worried about making these ones work, I'm not paying attention to this one. That comes first, and it filters out to everybody else. And that's the reflecting power of who God is. To understand, Paul, by the way, is not talking about simply a piece of bread and a cup of juice. That's not when he says the Lord's table. Do we understand? Can we please don't reduce it down to just the elements? It is, but it's more than that. Okay, so most likely, we've got to go back to historical now. Most likely, the service, every service included a meal together. Okay, approach it like Passover. In fact, actual historical Passover just happened a week ago. No, it does not happen at Easter. Okay, it happened last week. And so, Passover is a once a year event that the Jewish people will gather together in their home, and they will have a meal together to remember the Passover and the Exodus. And the meal is very important. The meal, by the way, about 6 hours long. That's a long meal. That's a lot of preparation to get that meal. Okay? And there is. Everything is, there's a huge amount of preparation. In fact, I was just reading, just a humorous little moment here. I was reading about when they would prepare the unleavened bread. But first they had to clean the entire house because you can't have any trace of leaven in the house, right? So the women would be just making the house spotless. And then they would make some bread, and you know what they would do with the bread? And I asked Wendy, maybe we should do this. I don't know. We didn't do this, by the way, just so you know. You're supposed to hide the bread. You're supposed to hide 10 pieces of bread all around the house. I think almost like a, I'm not good. Do I say it? Easter egg hunt? I mean, it's like, you got, beaten is not. Okay, no, Easter Passover, I'm not saying that. Okay, so, Pat, they got the bread out there, and the whole point is that they're supposed to go search for the bread. The kids are supposed to go search for the bread. The funny part is, it's not required to actually hide bread. It is required to go searching. I think that's hilarious. You shouldn't be looking for bread that's not there. But, that's just me. No, some of you are laughing, that's you too. And, we did not hide bread. Bread's all here. This meal, though, it had very important elements. And Jesus introduces us to communion through the Passover meal, because two of the elements that were there would be the bread and would be the cup. And so, understand, though, that they would do this once a year. We are called to do this every Lord's Day. It is our Passover. It is our Exodus. And it is every week. In fact, I would say that it's every time we get together as a church. Stop with the two or more gather thing, unless this is your purpose. Where two or more gather is not where church happens. By the way, that passage has nothing to do with church. But to say that as we gather together as a church, it has to be to remember, to reflect what he has done. To do anything other than that is not church. And it's something that the church and what the church function should have nothing to do with, is what Paul is saying. How do we apply that? Understand that this practice of coming together and having a meal and having a service, it was an early church practice. Something that, quite frankly, has gotten lost in the churches. Okay? In fact, when it comes to even the communion itself, what have we done in most cases? We have reduced communion to a little piece of styrofoam and a little tiny plastic cup that barely holds a drop. Is my God so small? Is that what God represents to me? I spent years and years and years thinking this is Jesus. I had a very small picture of Jesus. I didn't know it. And I'm not blaming the church for it. But there was a point in time in my life when I said, wait a minute, I think you figured it. And I always heard say, yeah, I don't want to see. That's me. We also turn around, we make communion this personal thing. It's just me and communion. Communion is not by yourself. It's not even in the word. Community. A communion was never intended to be a personal thing. We were never to be single. We were always meant to be plural. The church represents this plurality. So the early church for centuries, you understand that the Lord's Day was the Lord's Day. The whole day. They had church all day. And I know some of you are saying, Mike, it sometimes feels like that. They would prepare for that day. Before that day. Because they're going to spend that day. Just like we prepare for events. It's important to understand the cultural and historical context. Otherwise, Paul would just if he's not talking about a meal, it seems like he's making a really grand overstatement. Like, Paul, aren't you making a really big deal over a little piece of bread and a little cup of juice? That's a little much, isn't it? No, he's talking about this meal here, and we need to understand it in the context of this meal. The implication here is that some of the churches were feasting while those around them were going hungry. And they were doing it in the name of Jesus. They were saying, oh, we do this because of Jesus. We're not sharing everything, by the way. Other implications? There's lots of implications here. Other implications that there are those who felt, perhaps within the church itself, this is the divided groups, that they were more important than others, so they should be first in line. So when it comes to the meal, they should be in the place first in line, and therefore they should be able to get all that they wanted while others waited for them. Not a natural order of things, mind you, but just an order that suited them best. See, now the order is especially true in the Roman world. When you would have a feast, there would be seats of honor. And it was very important that you always had your seats of honor. You would never have somebody who should be in a seat of honor, not in the seat of honor, not in the Roman world. Think about Jesus' parable with the rich man and Lazarus. And you have this situation, you got this rich man who's just engorging himself with food, literally to the point where it's falling off of his face. And you have the poor man, Lazarus, who's not sitting at the table, but under the table. And he's just fighting, hoping for something to fall off this guy's face. And the dogs don't get it first.
Is that the Lord's table? Is that how the Lord's table should be treated? Is that what it means to consider others before yourself?
Oh, the rich man wanted to consider him once he found himself in a place of not so great. Too late. Another implication, in the situation, let's say we're having a meal. We would do it in the context of a potluck, right? Mm-hmm. If we're having a meal, who eats last? Well, there are two people who usually eat last when it comes to a meal. Servants eat last, and after the servants have been fed, then maybe mom gets to eat, right? I mean, that's usually the order of how things work. Which means that in some cases, there would be those people who simply didn't even get to eat because everybody else in line took everything before they even got a chance to. Now, I've watched our social committee, whether it be potlucks, funerals, whatever, I've watched them eat last. I've never heard them complain. But the reality is, okay, you can get some pretty slim tickets sometimes. Because let's face it, what's left is when somebody didn't take. Oh, we could have this attitude, you know. I've been guilty of this time. I don't want to work in the kitchen. Why? Because I won't get first dibs. Right? I mean, is that how we might approach? I don't want to serve because if I serve, then I never get to enjoy it. Don't we say that sometimes? Don't we think that sometimes? I don't want to be the guy who has. I don't want to sit out there popping popcorn. I want to watch the VeggieTale movie. Is that our attitude? Let's put it in actual every Sunday context for a moment here. You've been in line. I know this has happened. You've been in line. It's probably this line here. And you've been in line and you come up to the basket and there's only a couple pieces left and you know there's a whole line behind you still. So what do you do? Those deacons, they didn't put enough bread in this grumble. Well, no, don't do that. I'll just take one. I'm here, it's fine. The people behind them, they can figure out where to get their bread. I don't have to worry about them. Oh, well, I guess I could just tear off a little piece of the already little piece and hope that it keeps going. Maybe we'll have a fish and loaves moment. I don't know. Or, and I've seen this happen in more cases than not, somebody just comes over here. Grab some of the bread and put it over there. It's wonderful. But what do we do when we approach that home? Paul even talks about it, you can all sit down and order, and some of you get drunk. Well, where did that come from? Well, you have to understand, if he had worshiping the other temples and their feasts on, that was normal. In fact, it was expected. He's saying that doesn't have a place here. Don't do that here. That's not this table. Okay? And there will be those who they're not exercising self-control in that way. Saying it's not even drunkenness on alcohol necessarily. It's just they're not even in control of what they're doing. Gorging, whatever. And the attitude is, I'll do what I want to do. Nothing else matters. Everything, by the way, is lawful. So Paul's saying, I don't stand for this. Nobody should stand for this. This is not what the church is about. And he reminds them, the exercise of communion itself is not something that we should be taking lightly. Contentious. We shouldn't argue about it, fight over it. This is the right way, this is the wrong way. All of that's just the point of coming to it. After all, what has he just got done saying in terms of eating and drinking anyways? Do it all for the glory of God. Oh, there's that word glory. That we do it for the reflecting of who God is. That when we do this, it represents who he is, not who I am. And woe to us who don't feel the weight of communion. And why communion is here. And so he goes on, and these are the verses that perhaps you know. For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night that he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is a new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death, until he comes. I receive from the Lord Paul says. So I give you. You understand, everything that you have received from the Lord is not for you. It's for somebody else. He's using you to give it to them. That's the idea. With the exception of salvation. As he did, and that's exactly what Paul does in terms of the spiritual gifting. You're not gifted because God thinks you're so great. It's because the church needs this. And you're going to be the one to deliver it. I'm going to work through you. And so Paul is saying, God has worked through me and I am giving to you what he has given to me. So we'll revisit all that in chapter 11. But the idea here is that every gift comes with a mandate. It's for the body, not for self. And then he goes on to say, on the night he was betrayed. That's weighing heavy on us. That Jesus would do this knowing that the betrayal was coming. And Paul is, why does Paul insert? He doesn't have to insert that. He could just simply say, oh, Jesus gave me these instructions. Here they are. Now he reminds us of this betrayal. Why? Because we might betray him at the table too. Let's not do that. Let's not be that. We're to proclaim this until the Lord said until he comes. When does he come? New heaven, new earth. Hasn't happened yet. So what does that mean? We shouldn't stop doing this yet. When do we stop this? We stop when we get to sit at a different feast, a new table. And I look forward to that day. Until that day, this is the table that will remind me that that table's coming. When should we have communion? This is my understanding. Anytime you come together as a church, remember, that's what makes you a church. You can come together and not do it. Just don't pretend that you're church. Because that's not church. That's something else. It's okay to be something else, but don't call it what it isn't. Paul gives us a warning. Those who come to the table. Again, there's weight here. Whoever, therefore, eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. That is why many of you are weak and ill, and some have died. That's a pretty long statement. But if we judge ourselves truly, we would not be judged. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are disciplined so that we may not be condemned along with the world. So then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, so that when you come together, it will not be for judgment. But the other things I will give direction when I come. Even Paul knows when it's time to stop. Paul's rebuke comes with a reflection of grace. He's saying, it doesn't have to be this way. You're called to something more, to live different. You've been given the responsibility to reflect Christ in all that you do, and if there's any place that that should be demonstrated above and beyond all else, it should be at this table. It should be as a church, as a body, as one. So he says, so instead of making a mockery of that, you, individual, stop. Examine yourself. First, if you find guilt, by the way, you're in a room full of sinners, just to let you know. Don't think you're the only one. Sinners talking to you right now. If you find guilt, if you find that you are guilty of something, release it. Release it to the one who took the guilt of the world at the cross. Do we remember that it was paid for, right? Don't forget that it was already paid for before you walked through the door. Jesus prepared it before you got here. And he prepares a place for us, a seat at a greater table. But right now, remember why he has done what he has done. Yet there's this attitude sometimes I come with. Instead of admitting I'm ever wrong, I like to tell why other people are wrong. But that's how we judge, right? Instead of me saying I'm wrong, I'm going to tell you why you're wrong. Paul said, don't do that. Do you understand what that means? It's like Peter on the shore with Jesus, right? And he's told, Peter, this is what your life's going to look like. And what does Peter say? Well, what about him? What about him? Examine yourself for a moment. Peter, do you love me? Are you going to do as I have commanded? Are you going to go where Paul is asking, how fair would you honestly, at the end of the day, if you were in charge of your own judgment of yourself? And some of us are pretty good at beating ourselves up. But really, honestly, at the end of the day, how will we judge ourselves? and then at the same time turn around and how you might judge somebody else, how you might critique or criticize somebody else, how would you handle that critique on yourself? I think that's where that whole speck in your eye, or plank, or no, wait, it's a plank in my eye, speck in. That's how that all works, right? I mean, have you ever had that parent, you ever had that moment, you let the kids pick their punishment? Sometimes that doesn't work out so well, right? Sometimes the kid's like, I should be grounded for 3 years. And you're like, no, that's part of what we So, when we judge, you know, we got that whole picture of judge not lest you be judged. Do you understand what that means? That means that we have to be prepared to take what we did. Why don't we give grace instead? He said it real quick here, but I want to make sure we get some of these points. Some are sick and dying. This is not health, wealth, and prosperity gospel here. That's a lie. The preachers on TV are lying to you. This is about those that are in sin. And specifically, he's asking, why do you think you will be spared from the consequence of sin while you continue to sin? You're not. You're going to die. It's going to kill you. It's imminent. It's coming. We talked about that before. It's meaning you cannot partake in both tables, so stop trying. We aren't to be measured by the world, and we're not to be measured by each other. This is how the Roman Greco world did it. There were greater tables and greater seats. Even the disciples had a hard time with this one. Didn't they fight with Jesus himself? Who will get to sit next to you, Jesus? The point here is that there is a head of the table. There's only one head of the table. That's Christ. Paul's saying, you got to remember your role. You got to remember who you're under. And so Paul just simply concludes with a sensible word and a promise that, you know what, there'll be more to come. I've got way more to unpack here, but it's going to have to wait till I get there. And towards the end of the letter, he's like, and I hope you let me. He even gives them the opportunity to say, no, Paul, we don't want you anywhere near us. But honestly, it's really a sensible passage if we would just stop inserting our own agenda into it. It's very simple, the whole entire context. Consider others. What does it look like? It means wait for one another. Don't be in such a hurry. Don't fuss about what you're going to get out of it and whether you're going to get what you need out of it. But be concerned that others get what they need to get out of it. Don't consider yourself better. But be a servant. Eat last. Don't eat at all if necessary. Even Paul said, I'll stop eating if that's what it's going to take. Consider others. If you need to consider yourself, he's not saying don't consider yourself. He's saying just do that at home. Don't drag that in with you. Why? So that you have no distraction when you come into your time of prayer and prophecy with the body. That you have no distraction, and at the same time that you do not cause distraction. I've heard people say, I don't want to stay for the potluck. There's never anything for me to eat at the potluck. Fine. Okay, so you know that potlucks, and by the way, there's no potluck. If you're sitting there, we don't forget, there's no potluck. There's a reason for that. So if that's you, then fine. You eat at home before you come. Prepare yourself. Prepare yourself for the fact that there will be disappointment at the table. No. Prepare yourself that it's not a distraction. Prepare yourself at home so that you can do what the table was actually established for, which is not to eat, but to enjoy community. That's the purpose of the table, is to enjoy the community provided by God. And so prepare yourself that way instead of resenting the whole thing. I don't want to do all those other church activities. I just want to get in, get out. I have no Sunday school, no. I just give me the service and get me out of here. I get my check mark got my church on this week. Maybe we should consider that these events, all these other things, are not about you. They're meant for others. So come and be a part of the others. Can I say this? When you're at church, can you please be at church? Be here, not mentally thinking of where you need to be next. We do this. It's not just church that's happening. We do it all the time. In fact, that's the problem with our culture, I think, today. We're too busy thinking about what's next, and we forget where we are right now. And Paul's reminding us, don't you forget, this is his day. Not his hour. Not his 2 hours. His day. Give it to him.
So right now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take time. We're going to take time to practice in a small way. And we're going to do this with the bread that you brought. Now, I know right as soon as I said that, somebody said, oh, I forgot to bring bread. That's okay. Just bread. So with this bread that has been brought, and I hope that you made the bread, and from looking at the loaves here, this is true. You brought bread that you enjoy. Right? You brought the bread that you enjoy, and I hope that you brought the bread that you enjoy that others will enjoy it. And that would be the goal, that they would enjoy it. You might not even have some of your bread. That's okay. And so, with that kind of heart and that kind of mind, that's how we glorify God. That to remember that He gave His best, His one and only Son, to us. That when we give our best to one another, we are reflecting what He has already done, not what we came up with. And that's what we do. And we come together in this time of communion. And the worship team is going to come, and they're going to play a song softly. And this is a time for reflection, to remember that as we come to the bread, to understand that I've taken a piece of the bread here, which I understand to be unleavened bread on top of everything else. And he sat there at that table, and when he took that bread, he said, wait a minute, I've got a picture here. But he said, he's the bread of life. We're supposed to reflect it. He said that too. He's the light of the world. But he took the bread at the table, the bread that would have been there, the bread that would have reminded them, the bread that would have been hidden around the house, remind them that there's a promise. And he's saying, I am that promise. This is me. This is my body. And he takes it, and then he breaks that bread, and he says, this is for you. I'm going to the cross for you. The disciples had to look at him like he was crazy. Like, Jesus, that's not part of the Passover script. Of all people, Rabbi, you should know this.
We'll do something a little bit bigger and a little bit better.
And he gave that bread to him. He said, this is my body. It's for you. He took the cup, and the cup that had the juice, the wine, right? He takes the cup, and he says, this is my blood. Not literal. This is my blood. This represents the covering of sin. This represents a new covenant. Not the covenant that Adam was under. Not the covenant that Moses or Abraham or David were under. But the covenant. My covenant. My relationship with you. And he does it. So here's what I'm going to ask you to do. Worship team's going to play a song softly. And during that time, I'm going to ask you to do something. It's going to be uncomfortable for some. And I also ask that for those of you who this might be, it's more of a practicality thing, you accommodate one another. But I want you to gather into small groups. I would even challenge you, gather into a group, perhaps that isn't the normal group that you might gather into. Of course, if you have a family, gather together with your family. But to gather together in small groups, not too big, 4 or 5 people. Okay. And to gather into that small group, and if you notice, we have done service way differently this morning. And that's all of it is, by the way, in order and with intention. We did not greet one another. We did not spend the time in prayer this morning. Why? Because this is the things that we do with one another in community. And so that's the invite for you right now, is you find that small group, you gather together, and first you say, how can we be praying for one another? And somebody, just one somebody, take the lead and take a moment and pray. That's not too long. You pray. You prepare yourself for the table. And then send somebody, just one person from your group. You come and you come to the table. And there is unleavened bread. And there is, I know there's names for these breads. There's some fancy bread here. And there's a Turkish bread here. And there's even breadless bread here. It's gluten free, and you keep them separate. But it's good bread. That's all good. But you come and it's cut. So you just take a chunk. Okay, don't take a little piece. Take a chunk and take it back with you. Come over and I'll be up here, and the guy's gonna be up here. We're gonna be pouring some of these cups as you come up. And you take a cup back with you. Okay, one cup, one chunk of bread. Go back and then have communion with one another. Okay? Celebrate Him, because if you come to church and you can't celebrate Him, don't come to church. That's what Paul's saying.
And so you come and you take that bread and you take that cup, and somebody in your group, and if you have been listening to my message at all this morning, you should know by now who at least one of somebody should be. Somebody in that group, you lead the way, and you make sure everybody gets to eat, and however you want to do it, however the groups come to us, you want a small group. There, pass the bread, everybody take a chunk off of it. Somebody take a chunk and hand it off. I know some people, I'm a germaphobe, I am, but I can handle this. Okay? So take it, have communion with one another. Praise God with one another. And then the worship team also has a closing song that we'll sing, and we'll be done with the service. But I would ask that in your small group that you would take this opportunity. Now, I do want to say this. Okay? Communion is for anyone that is in covenant relationship with Jesus. That means you have given Him your life, you understand His authority is your head. If you are here this morning and you are not in right relationship with Him, you are not in a place to be in right relationship with Him, which I would beg to differ, I believe that you can. But if you're not, or if you are in a place right now where you do not have a relationship at all, you do not know Him, He does not know you, you have just wandered into the church and you're going handy people to do that. And welcome. Don't take part in the communion. But that does not mean do not take part in the community. Still gather together. And I know that can be weird. Just don't take it. Just simply let it pass by. That's okay. And then I'm going to ask, I'm going to call upon that group to take a certain level of maturity and do this. No pressure, no judgment. And this is not a time for you to say, are they saved or are they not saved? What's going on? They're not taking communion. That's it. That's all that's happening. Let that be. But embrace community. Demonstrate for you amongst the small group your love, your submission, His glory. You pray, and you find your way. That's it. And there's no dismissal. Okay? Songs will be sung, and when you're done with your group, and you want to stay all day with your group, stay all day. Father God, thank you so much for the gift of your Son. I thank you, Father, you have taught me I cannot be just me. I cannot be alone. It's not good. But you have given me. You have given me your Son. Father, you have given me a wife. You have given me children. Father, you have given me a church family. Father, I pray that each one of us would examine our hearts this morning. We would recognize that all things come from you. That all things are to you. Giving praise and glory to you. I pray that as we take this time of communion, that Father, it will be a time that, Lord, that you would be glorified in all of these things. I thank you, I praise you, and give you the glory. We love you. And we come to you in the name of your Son. Amen.